This is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, so this is from a lecture on a new book that has come out called The George Floyd Uprising, edited by the Vortex Group. I'm just going to read you, and this features Idris Robinson and others who shall remain nameless. So let me just read you the back of the book jacket. In the summer of 2020, America experienced one of the biggest uprisings in half a century. After George Floyd's murder at the hands of Minneapolis police, angry crowds took to the streets night after night, fighting the police, looting, and eventually burning down the Third Precinct. The revolt soon spread to cities large and small across the country, where rioters set police cars on fire, sacked luxury shopping districts, and forced the president into hiding in a bunker beneath the White House. Throughout the summer and into the fall, localized rebellions continued to erupt in Atlanta, Chicago, Kenosha, Louisville, Philadelphia, and elsewhere. Written during the riots, The George Floyd Uprising is a compendium of the most radical writing to come out of that long, hot summer. These incendiary dispatches from those on the front lines of the struggle examine the new horizons opened by the revolt, as well as the social, tactical, and strategic obstacles it confronted. This practical, inspiring collection offers a toolbox for all those effectively seeking to expand and intensify revolts in the future, and it is essential reading for everyone interested in toppling the state, racism, and capitalism. And just one disclaimer, myself, my own opinion, if poverty is not violence, then certainly vandalism is not violence, and violence is something perpetrated on someone against their will. So, unfortunately, the FCC does not agree with me, so this station, we do not advocate the overthrow of the United States government. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Touch on topics of, like, race and abolition and imagining what that looks like in a post-George Floyd rebellion era. I just thought, you know, I know we've distroed a lot of how it might should be done. Basically everybody here, so I think it just certainly resonates with me, and I think the experience of Eugene during the George Floyd Uprising there. So we had there was a very brief insurrectionary moment, you know, on May 29th here, 2020, when people had a riot in Eugene. And there's looting that happened, but then this basically just got quickly denounced, like, across the board by, of course, there's, like, the right wing freaking out about it, whatever, but really it was coming from the left, mm-hmm. and it was coming from professional activist types, it was coming from nonprofit types, it was coming from white liberals in Eugene, and they have an entire apparatus, they have, you know, city clubs that are on the boards of all these real money movers in town, you know, but they kind of imagine, Eugene kind of imagines itself like on an island, you know, like aside from this racist hotbed of the rest of the Willamette Valley and kind of more generally like America. That's the people that were like mobilizing to kind of spread this narrative. Or at least maybe their constituency, and it was very swiftly crushed, but because people were saying things like, oh, well, white people partaking in a riot, like, it's making this should be like a black-centered movement, you know, and like white people partaking in a riot, it's kind of like hijacking this thing, and we need to listen to like what other black leaders are saying and stuff like that, and you know, it's like you really just got a question, like, who do they mean when they say that? Mm-hmm. Who are they talking about we should listen to? You know what I mean? Because it's always like we got to listen to people, you know, that, like, we're going to listen to small business owners, you know? We're going to listen to, like, people that kind of check all these, like, boxes of oppression or something like that. Like, I don't know how you even go about doing that, but I think, like, at least from my perspective, it's like people in Eugene, when they rioted because of George Floyd, it was like the deepest act of solidarity they could do with black people in the country at that moment, because there was a nationwide rebellion happening, you know what I mean? And like, and yeah, just for it to be denounced by it, like being like, oh, well, the white participants couldn't be in solidarity with Black Lives Matter or whatever, and they are racist themselves for participating in this kind of way, like, just really shut things down here. I think that Eugene wasn't ready to grapple with that question at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, but now, years later, here we are, right? Yep. So, yeah, it's just important to keep having these discussions and conversations, because this is going to get mobilized again next time that there's an outbreak here. So, or an outbreak in the U.S. in general, you know what I mean? We kind of already have seen, like, this prototype of that with, like, how Tyre Nichols, mm-hmm. the Tyre Nichols situation mm-hmm. just got handled, but we need to, like, be clear that... We want to like break this link between like civil society and its institutions and us as a revolutionary movement. And I think that's what I want people to think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely right.
I heard a little clap going. I think we're
So, but anyway, it's cool to be in Eugene. It's cool to be, it feels like coming full circle. Like, I remember, I'm aging myself a little bit, but I remember in high school, in my senior year of high school, you know, seeing the smashing, the black smashing for the first time on the news, and the reporter saying, like, they came from their hideout in Eugene to destroy them. Why is there not me here, right? So, and like many of you, I'm sure there's someone who has a common experience here. I always intuitively felt something was wrong with the world, but I did not express that at the time. And I think seeing the glass shatter there really showed me how I should like actually put forth my dissatisfaction. So once again, I heard the pop bang smack, and I knew I had to get down with that. So now I'm here, right, chasing the dragon, and trying to keep the dragon out of the cage was really the impetus to writing How Might She Be Done. I think, you know. I mean, it was almost like a joke. I'll just tell you guys this, right? Like, it was like, oh, we're gonna do a talk in the Chaz. And then, like, they did riot the day before, and then we were just super amped and did it, right? And, you know, I was writing it to the last minute, but it worked out like that. But the real idea was just what I wanted to do was try to facilitate a dialogue just to keep the riots going, right? And somewhat for my own selfish reasons, right? Like, I just, you know, there's this great DeBoer line where he's like, I've read most than most people have read, and I've written less than most people who have written, but there's one thing I can do in life, and that's drink. But mine is riot, right? I really just wanted it to keep going on. And I did see, right, as Alfredo was saying, there were all these roadblocks, I think, blocking the furtherance of the riot. And then if it blocks the furtherance of the riot, it blocks the possibility of the transition from insurrection to revolution. So what I was trying to do was just identify some of those things and try to say, you know, in very plain English, as much as I can for the continentalese I kind of write in, that this is where the problem lies, right? But with every riot, but especially I think in 2020, we get a brief glimpse of what it would be like to be in a world that's completely subverted and toppled oppression, right? So. You know, when I was writing from this kind of perspective as, like, I just don't want to go back to the ordinary world that I know before this, right? So, and what I really do view kind of the world we live in as a hell, and, like, it's a hell that has just enough oxygen for us to breathe every day and keep its fire going. So, as you guys know now, I have all the stuff that you guys already know about. When I did How Much You Done, it was in 10 theses, and it started off, the first thesis was a militant nationwide uprising did in fact occur, right? However, it was the progressive wing of the counterinsurgency that sought the denial and disarticulation of the event. And what I was trying to get across was trying to say that each of us in the summer were really experiencing something unprecedented and really extraordinary. And I think that I know it was something that had never been before seen in American history, right? The rioting was really extensive, and intensive, right? It was in the farthest, most remote corners of the United States. So Sioux Falls, South Dakota, these places like I don't even have a conception of, right? I don't even think you could hop a freight train through there, right? You know, Reno, Nevada, Davenport, Iowa. Like, what the hell is Davenport, Iowa? No disrespect to them. What, you been to Davenport?
No, I'm just saying, Davenport, I was following it. It was crazy.
Yeah, they were throwing down.
Exceptionally violent.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of these places, they got busy. So, like, extensive and intensive, right? Alaska had stuff, right? You know? And, you know, I mean, it's probably, like, my New York-centric view, but I just didn't think there were black people in Davenport, Iowa. Goes to show. Someone was out there, you know? But since this place is by no means unacquainted with that kind of activity, right? And the map indicated, I looked a little bit before I came here, I looked at the map. There's an uprising map down on Wikipedia. Have you seen this yet? Oh, yeah. You check it out. Yeah, yeah. And it'll, like, point you in what happened in what place. And it seemed like here, I researched it a little before I got here, but you guys broke a few windows yourself, it seems like, and maybe toppled a few statues, which made a big deal, right? The president didn't like that, from what I understand, right? But what I argued there was that there are two main strategies towards containing the uprising, and I think Fredo put it really well. Like, the first strategy was typically deployed by sectors of the right, and you guys know this, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir, but by sectors of the right and the conservatives, and that acknowledges that the event occurred in order to smash it, right? So the enemy has to really say this did happen in order to try to suppress it and bring it down by force. But what I didn't really articulate until the second one was that there's a kind of imaginary dimension to this where the right mobilizes this kind of transcendent historical, ahistorical ideal in order to crush the uprising. So, for example, they'll say, you know, this is breaking law and order, or in the name of the nation or the state. But in this country specifically, it's going to be white supremacy and settler colonialism. And the second strategy, which is the way more insidious strategy, has the ambit of the liberals and the left, as we were already talking about. And it's an essentially reformist strategy, and that is to deny or at least mystify the event in order to direct it back into reformist aims, right? And this way, they try to pass off the revolt as mainly peaceful protests, but if it goes down to Davenport, Iowa, it's going down, right? So let's be like honest about that. And it tries to extinguish the flames by maintaining that they've never been lit, right? So it's a different one than the right. And it strives to reinsert this all, again, for reformist ends. So again, it's a move that shifts the impulse of this complete overturning of the racist order into some sort of piecemeal progressive civil rights legislation. And we've seen how far that's gone, right? So we know that trap. But now to top it off, what I think is the more important thing to talk about today is there's a grander strategy, I think, used to erase the uprising. And that's nothing other than the persistent historical amnesia that blankets all of American life, right? Mm-hmm. So the endless perpetuation of the present is undoubtedly, I think, the most crippling counter-revolutionary weapon wielded against us. And okay, of course I have to quote DeVore at some point, so So he says that spectacular domination's first priority was to make historical knowledge in general disappear, beginning with just about all rational information and commentary on the most recent past. The evidence of this is so glaring that it's hardly need any further explanation. With mastery, the spectacle organizes ignorance of what is about to happen, and immediately afterward, the forgetting of whatever has nonetheless been understood. The most important is the most hidden. So in other words, if this historical amnesia prompts us to forget yesterday, then 3 months ago and 3 years ago, i.e. the uprising, is really doomed to fade into oblivion. I really traveled all the way out here, right? When we were talking about it, when there was discussion about where we're gonna go for the book tour, I was like, I want to go to Oregon, right? And I wanted to, you know, because I wanted to hear what you guys had to say about the uprising and what your experiences were. But before that, I want to try my best to bring you back into the mode of the uprising, since there's so much working against us remembering it. And for those of you that have given a large part of yourselves to the revolt, I suspect that it was one of the rare times in your lives where everything finally made sense. So, What could be more coherent and what could be more humane than directing our anger against the cops instead of directing at the people we love and those we care for? And these initial steps, in the move from survival to life, I think of it as something as returning home, right? Instead of bringing about something now, it tops our innermost selves. It taps into our innermost selves. There we go. And that way, we finally become what we're supposed to be, right? So what I'm trying to say here is that, you know, a lot of times we think of revolution as something new, and I kind of think of it as finally being what we're really supposed to be, right? Nothing other than the fully ethical and cultivated human beings that we're meant to be. And so this isn't intended as a kind of thought experiment to bring you back into the mind of the revolt, but it's also necessary to consider how far we've moved from it, right? And we need to take gauge of that, right? How much has changed in the past 3 years as well. So, in other words, an accurate assessment of where we're at today would entail determining how far the counter-revolution has recolonized all the aspects of our everyday lives. What else? And even though it's going to be painful, and it means measuring the distance away from the selves we have always wanted to be, as the old Italian communist Amadeo Bordiga used to say, everyone knows how to orient themselves at the moment of victory, but few know how to do so in those moments of defeat when it becomes complicated and it persists. All right? And last quote of the day, I'll say, is the comrade poet Sean Bonney describes it, says the agony of the collective eye gradually and painfully returning to its former isolated individuality. So nevertheless, to be a revolutionary really involves facing and recognizing this reality and this loss for what it is, right? And it's difficult, but I think the worst thing to do is to say, okay, that anger that we had, and this is probably largely subconscious, to say that anger that we had in the streets, now we can't direct it anywhere, we're gonna direct it at our friends and at our comrades, right? And if you stay around enough, and I think you guys all will, right, you'll see it a million times, it'll go down, then a year later, the people who were running next side by side each other hate each other because she did this or he did that, right? So to sugarcoat reality in front of us would be to grant forgiveness that we're in no position to do. Worse, it would mean forsaking our inescapable duty to the dead. And we have to feed the hate in order to nurture our love. The hate that we have for the enemy and the love that we have above all for those who have been taken away from us. For Tortuguita, for Michael Reinold, for Tyree Nichols, and nonetheless, for all the nameless victims on the militarized borders and prisons in our society. So, for this reason, it's not at all wrong to think that the uprising and all the struggles that have followed in its wake as simply the only thing that matters. They actually encompass everything because they encompass both life and death. And in this country, I don't have to remind you that the stakes of life and death often boil down to black and white. Hence, I argue that revolution in America entailed civil war. Because not just white supremacy, but the white race as such would have to be destroyed. To tear down this nation means to tear down the most heavily guarded distinction between us. And even though this might require renouncing our base existence, it should not be confused with sacrifice. The death of the white race alongside the risk of physical death is a wager for something higher. It is the reach for something this world simply can't provide to us. And this way, being a traitor, the race traitor ambition was always right. The abolitionist project and its betrayal of whiteness is fundamentally a commitment to the good life and humanity.
Humanists. All right, hey everybody. So I'm here from Portland, and I'm really grateful to be down here and to be in a moment of remembering, that memory, that re-invoking of the other space that we found amongst each other and in confrontation, that when the spectacle shatters with those glass windows and with those statues coming down, when it shatters with the flashbangs, when it shatters and we discover motion and movement and creativity and dynamism, that is, as it is just saying, the heart of what we are reaching for and what is also always there. but becomes masked, becomes shrouded, becomes overwhelmed by this reproduction of empire through us, through our lives that we fight against, we struggle against, and yet returns over and over again. And so I think that I spent the last few days just rereading all pieces in this book, and I found it a real gift, a gift from our recent past, and so I'm inviting us to do that together in this conversation, and also as we go on, and there's other moments too. It's not only 2020 as the only moment. That was just a moment which gave us the high watermark of the recognition of how fragile, ultimately, as with all its power, with all its venom, of how fragile this world is and can be. And despite what we've lost, despite how we've hurt through this process, it's that aspirational return to the motive, the underlying force of the vitality that we found in those streets, in those moments, that I'm encouraging us to remember through this talk to now. And so this book is not univocal at all, right? It's not speaking in one voice. There's a variety of different perspectives and opinions. I'm speaking from Portland. I was part of the crew that wrote the Rhythm and Ritual, the Portland piece. But there's a lot of different narratives here, right? So one of the values of this is to kind of trace step by step the real differences that happen in different places. We talked a little bit about Eugene. Portland's just right up the road, and it was different, and I'll touch on that a little bit. And then it was different in Minneapolis, it was different in Atlanta, it was different in Davenport, but I think it was that.
Davenport. Yeah, Davenport in the house.
And I think that there's, I wouldn't want to kind of gloss this all as a single moment or a single suite of experiences, because that would kind of diminish the richness that we have here to recognize that even in just this one long hot summer, there was a wealth of experiment and experience and evolution and change and resurgence and defeat and resurgence again. And I think that sort of tactical knows, that tactical wisdom that people developed in the streets together actually can speak really deeply as well to the question of how do we both live our lives in a way that maintains and enlivens some presence with the truth that underlies this death hell of empire, and then also prepares ourselves and also those around us and those that will be the next generations, whether that's 5 years younger or whether that's the generations to come. Because this journey of the death of empire that we're in, right? This journey that I think that many younger folks coming up now feel as like the entire frame of our world, of the nihilism, the sense of apocalypse. This is the most aspirational and beautiful and hopeful thing that I think that is true in the historical moment right now. And so one of the main themes throughout this book, and there's different perspectives on it, analytical frames, there's different experiences that people had in the different towns, but one of the common themes is how do we relate to blackness and to the black uprising and to the idea of the black radical tradition and this animating force of what spearheaded this punch in the face of empire. So that's what I want to just touch on right now. Is like what are some of the lessons? What are some of the moments, the opportunities, the creativity that we experienced, and then what were the limits? And then what are maybe some things that we can think about going forward to animate that in our lives moving on? So I guess for me, some of the key themes it really wasn't the left or radicals, like the pre-existing radical scenes in most of the U.S. that were the core of the folks that threw down. It was new folks. It was folks that
that discovered something inside themselves and threw themselves into a moment. And that's a really important reminder. Sometimes in our scenes, we get kind of caught up in who's this, who's that, what's this, what's that. It's all up to us, you know? And it's really, by historical, obvious fact, not that way. And so then when the question really becomes, what is our role? What is the role, and I'm saying our here, but because, you know, all of us, what is the role of those that have been through it before? And who, you know, a different version, it's always going to be different in you, but what can we offer to those that come in? The most important thing, though, is that it can be unexpected, it can be beyond what we imagined, right? Secondly, all these regular folks that were not woke, folks that were not necessarily knowing all of the correct lingo, didn't have all of the correct analytical frameworks, these folks discovered in this moment, in the throwdown, in the fight, discovered a field of action beyond what's legible. In other words, beyond what can be like seen and described and talked about, which is really the field of the social movement apparatus that actually came in and became operated in the counterinsurgency. And this really helps us see that the distinction between reform and revolution is not really, if we want to use that frame, it's like not the only frame, but it's not really about a disagreement about tactics. It's not a disagreement about what's the best way to get to the same ultimate goal. Because what's different is what's in our bellies, is the fire, right? Are we called, are we fully, like this movement, this right? Is that there for us? Right, and ultimately a reformist mode, even for people that have that, if they get caught up in it, there's all kinds of ways of being co-opted and being bought out, but it's also just an ideological framework that is molasses, and it sucks us in, and it ultimately becomes the kind of like a quicksand, and what ends up happening is that it ultimately becomes rearranging the furniture, rearranging the who has access to assimilation, right? And so this is why the power of I think this is one of the continuities between Eugene and Portland was Black unity. Is this, am I right about that?
Yeah.
So y'all had a very experienced crew of folk at demobilizing us, right? And that crew moved up to Portland and was really influenced with Road City Justice. We're going to talk about some of the specifics. And luckily in Portland, for whatever reason, we were able, especially thank God for Trump, it was because of the right wing acknowledging that the uprising happened, and therefore their attempt to fight it actually reminded us that it's real, right? And then in that moment, in that struggle, in the streets, we developed this recognition of swooping, of being able to give this like ongoing night after night, this experience of crews coming in and trying to redirect to guilt trip people, right? And then the recognition that, hey, actually, there are different Black voices, right? There are different voices and those different voices have a different relationship with that fire in the belly. And that's kind of where I want to kind of bring us back to is we, all of us, like there's different ways that we have it, there's different sources of it, but it's our connection to that utter contempt and hate for the empire, for this world, for this white man's world, for this world of emptiness and hollowness and the spectacle, the different ways that we get into it, it's that gives us that sense of we're in it together, right? And that, I think, was what we found when we found each other in the streets, not the ones on the mic, usually, but the ones who were like, fuck that, we're gonna go.
Yeah.
Right? And that's that there's something there for us to remember. To remember that we're gonna find that not necessarily always with the ideologies, not necessarily always with the fancy language, maybe not often, but with regular folks who are in motion. Right, and that was what happened. Race was partially superseded in the streets in these moments, and it helps us understand that wokeness, that this ideology of kind of hyper carefulness and like talking the game, is ultimately a cop-out. It's ultimately a betrayal of the true dynamism of abolition. Not abolitionism that becomes this whole big thing, blah blah blah, but that of the momentum and the rawness that aligns us with something that moves beyond and lives into the death of empire. The death of empire. And we have to choose. We don't get to just be like, we're going to follow whichever leader is in front of us, or whoever says something to us the fastest or guilts us the most. That's the cop-out. We don't get to make that choice. And I think that was one of the most powerful things in Portland for us, was that everyone recognized that they had to make that choice. That choice was every night, over and over and over. And people developed an awareness, a tactical awareness for how to navigate it. Not perfect, and we lose a lot of it. We come back into this framework, this anti-oppression analysis, which again is the mechanism of this counterinsurgency. So that's one of the main themes of this book, is the mechanism of counterinsurgency, often led by a black NGOist, class compromised kind of infrastructure. So let's remember that. Let's bring that into ourselves. Now, a lot happened in that time, but we also had a lot of limits. Those limits were those counterinsurgencies and the effectiveness of them. Those limits were that one of the arguments here was that we need to take our race treachery not just in terms of feeling great that we're against everything, but actually moving further and just splitting the white proletariat. What does it mean to actually split white folks, to destroy whiteness in a way that reaches people who are currently saying the wrong things, who are currently very vulnerable to that white racist dynamic as a form of identity, as a form of finding groundedness in a world that seems empty and hopeless, right? We have to contest that space, and we've not been great at it. And I think we really found that really strongly here in the Northwest, where that culture war contestation became guns out, right? And that was before, but it's really been amped up then and since. There's a way in which that sort of set piece, it's completely structured. Everyone knows who's on what side based on what clothes you're wearing, based on what words you use. It limits our ability to actually destroy whiteness. So we need to be careful about that. And that was a real limit. We talked about the exhaustion and the infighting that comes, and this is so familiar. And this, we did not avoid this in 23, certainly not in Portland. I don't know how it's been elsewhere. You know,
Davenport had it down.
Yeah. And we got beat over and over again, and there was power in it, and people had we had each other's back, but it was exhausting and traumatizing. And what were the ways that we were able to hold each other? What are the ways next time that we're going to be able to hold each other through that better and for longer? And then it's also hard for us to see what we want, right? I know a lot of people who feel like we just fucking lost. And of course, in some ways, we lost some things. Of course, some of the visions of what we thought abolition meant were impossible because they were completely compromised. A lot of what we talked about was ultimately within a reformist landscape. And you know, I'm not going to make any quotes to Benjamin or anyone else, but this is this is. I'm not going to get it exactly, but you know, this is the war that we keep losing until we win, right? Forever, right? Until we win, but that though, all of these losses will be reinscribed once the empire dies, and it will die. It is dying, right? It can go better or worse. The sooner it dies, the fucking better for all of us, right? But it is dying, and so the memory of all of these struggles, including this one, 2020, including the next one, is going to be reinscribed within a different narrative and a different story. And so when we can remember what we won, we've undermined cops' effectiveness, like, really deeply. And they've, of course, ramped shit up, but it makes that cops, the worst cops are the cops in our head, and those are that's harder for them to navigate anymore, right? So that changed in the United States. Certainly changed in Portland. Portland's got, like, they didn't defund the cops, but there's like 70% of the cops that were before, so they can't hire cops, right? So that's a victory of a sort. right? And there's an antagonism that the uprising represented, a sort of complete abolition that is now on the cards and in our bellies and in the bellies of tens of thousands of people who were in it and hundreds of thousands of people who were close to it. Maybe millions, right? So, what do we do? What are the ways that we have now in the between time, in the lull, to deepen the visceral and vital antagonism against empire that brings white and black together, where indigenous people are a part of a world beyond and against empire that we can be in cahoots with, right? What are our ways to do that don't simply escalate into a shooting war? That's another theme in these texts is about the incremental escalation, right, towards more and more guns. Some places start with a lot of guns, some people got guns later, but like guns emerged all over the place. And guns are real, guns are a part of it. What are the pitfalls of just going further and harder and harder and further until the guns come out, and then after the guns come out? There's opportunities there, but there are real limits. So are there other things that we can do? Are there other forms of escalation? Are there other ways of animating that fire and revulsion and that commitment to the death of empire than only the shooting war? And then there will be shooting and there will be war, but we have to think beyond that only, right? And beyond class, beyond the framing of class in a sort of, we can talk about class. Let's talk about class. But what are resources for ending this nihilism, this emptiness, this sense of despair, the sense of hopelessness, the sense that we're dead, right? The sense that we're a walking dead, just distracting ourselves with fucking TikTok and shit until it all dies, right? This is all around us. We're swimming in it. It's scary. It can feel hopeless, but isn't this really the sort of death that black folk have been living inside and through and beyond for 500 years, right? And if so, is that potentially a way in which we can find in ourselves not just solidarity, not some sort of like altruism for others, but a commitment for ourselves for something that where we are alive beyond that death? That we can be in living motion with others who have been doing that for much longer. That's an opportunity. I wonder how to explore that, how to animate that, how to share that. And then I want to remember that this life-affirming aspect of 2020, which in Portland had a strong, you know, evolution into the mutual aid infrastructure. There's tons of critiques of mutual aid infrastructure, sort of social service, like we're going to replace the state by working ourselves to the bone. You know, and it's got limits, but there's something in it. There's something in it that speaks to this hospitality, this care for each other, this we're going to love and support one another, right? And it's our duty to win. So winning has to seek resources for this revolutionary antagonism and also love, wherever we can find it. So I want to get creative with that. I want to find where that is in Eugene. I want to find where that is all over this continent and all around the world. And for me, and for many of those in this text, although not everyone, the black radical tradition is
not for one guy, right?
Not for one.
Like, calm the fuck down, bro. Not you, yeah, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a resource. It's an unfinished story that, in the deepest ways, 2020 offered an opening for us to become part of that story. For those ancestors to be our ancestors, and for those descendants to be our descendants, and for us to become the people that they need us to be. All right. So now it's y'all.
Yeah. I've got a question. Is it Idris or Idris?
Idris.
Idris.
Yeah, yeah. What's your name?
I'm Ev.
What was that?
Ev.
Adam. Nice to meet you, Adam.
I was really thinking about one of the first things you said was keep the dragon out of the cage, which got me thinking about that Mao quote.
I think it's Ho Chi Minh.
It's
huh?
Ho Chi Minh?
Yeah, when the dragon lets
when the dragon gets out of the cage.
Yeah.
Which became George Jackson's thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which got me thinking about, you ever read that Joy James article about George Jackson, Angela Davis, and
the one where she's dissing Angela Davis?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fire.
It's fire.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it,
yeah.
It was like, that was part of like, I think that and how it might should be done, like sort of mutually informed each other in a lot of ways.
Word.
Especially with like the liberal disarticulation of the revolutionary movement.
Word.
And there's this like ambiguity in abolitionist movements as like she tries to, you know, untangle between George Jackson and Angela Davis.
Yeah.
Where on the one side you have Angela Davis, you know, like biggest political prisoner support group in fucking history or whatever.
Yeah.
But still Angela Davis, you know, says within the framework of the state, I'm innocent. Whereas, you know, George Jackson and other black liberation militants say, like, this is a state of war, and, like, or lied the, you know, dichotomy of innocence and guilt through, like, you know, and, like, that reveals, like, sort of a dichotomy that, like, still we've inherited in the abolitionist frameworks, you know, with, on the one hand, like, the, you know, militant black prison movement, and on the other hand, like, the academic, you know, which sort of, like, for me, at least, like, exists in the ambiguity of abolition coming to mean, like, the police is a middle ground between, like, prison and, like, you know, it identifies a specific institution rather than the whole prison world, you know? But anyways, all you all were talking about, like, you know, forgetting memory and trying to bring us back into, like, the framework of the revolt that, like, sort of is lost, been lost to time with us as things have changed or whatever, and thinking about, like, forgetting is like the mechanism of counter-revolution in like capitalist temporality or whatever, and sort of, I don't know, trying to like, trying to ask you like, what is like revolutionary memory look like in a concrete way of like bringing something back? Because of course it's like not bringing something back. Well, I don't know, like the capitalist temporality of, as for the obverse side of forgetting the past is like postponing any future. It exists in a sort of totalizing present that always says it always will be and always was and whatever. And yeah, like concretely, like what is, I'm trying to, yeah, think about like memory as like what is, you know, it means to like connect this tradition of revolt and open like prison cages and also like, you know, for instance, like one of the OG abolitionist guerrillas was the George Jackson Brigade between Olympia and Eugene, like listening to, you know, Bo Brown talk about driving to Eugene to get fake IDs or whatever. Yeah, it's just memory, like what do you think about it?
That was dope, really dope question.
Yeah,
the way you said it, it's really, you should write that.
Yeah,
no, for real, it's really dope. Yeah, really, really dope. Yeah. So, what does it look like? Well, okay, I can be long-winded with answers, so just bear with me. Right? Yeah. So, for a long time, I have all these weird kind of normative standards that I put on myself, right? And one was like I never read a radical text from an American. Right? Bear with me, right?
Yeah.
But you know, from like most of my life, right, if you read the American text, I was like, this is ridiculous, right? You know, and then so like why would I read this when I could read something from, say, Greece, right, or something like that, right? You know? And just because it didn't have any seriousness, right? But one of the things that was really important to me, and one of the things that and this kind of gets at what you were saying, Brush, was that this was the first time in my life where I saw people writing stuff in America, and I'm like, this is real revolutionary thought, right? This is, it's informed by praxis, right? And like, it's going somewhere, it means something, right? But the times where I think they didn't work, and I don't want to diss the people who I thought wrote whack stuff, right? But they're out there, right? But, and some in that book. But, but you know, the difference I thought was this, was right, like when, you know, in I do have this visceral hatred for America in the sense like where you know, I don't read American authors, right? I choose to never watch American news, right? And a lot of that changed during the uprising. Like, I was watching NBC News, so I'm like, it's going down here, you know what I mean? This is dope now, right? And even my wife and I, we were in Hawaii during the uprising at one of the points, and we went to some stuff out there. We went to two demos there, and we met this older gentleman who, he was in Vietnam, and he had, like, attacked his commanding officer and was on the brig, right? And he said from the same day, yeah, he was dope, right? Okay, I'm just going to keep going on, right? Because we went to this Juneteenth there, and it was, like, the most black capitalist, Christian black barbecue ever. And then, like, eventually I was like, and they were just going on, like, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, Jesus did this, right? And I was like, all right, now I'm going to have to say something. I'm on vacation. I gotta talk some shit, right? And this oldest, I mean, he must have been 75. He came up, and he just cursed everyone out, right? And he was like, George Floyd. So, and then he just left. And I was like, oh, shit. So, of course, I'm like, we got to go find this guy, right? So the next, like, we took a day. We were just looking around trying to find him. We finally found him. And one of the things he said to me, and you know, he gave me his book of poetry, he gave me his autobiography, he wrote his memoirs, and he was like, I was looking at his books, and he's like, you notice, yeah, there's no Americans in the literature, and he's like, I don't read Americans because they don't tell me anything I need to know, right? And like, I read Dostoevsky, right? And I always felt that intuitively also, right? Like, saying like, I think it's changed a lot in high schools, but we just had to read a bunch of American bums, right? You know, and I felt the same with a lot of the radical texts that came out, but that changed during the uprising, right? But one of the differences that showed if the texts were important to me was that they could rely on historical evidence to actually pull through what they were trying to say, right? And you know, whatever Shimon, like a lot of his, what Shimon said that was really important to me was the prelude to Civil War, and to say, okay, we're not gonna look at the commune, we're gonna look at our Civil War, right? And take something from that, right? Or even with the Joy James text you cited, right? Is to say like, okay, where is the reformist dynamic in this hodgepodge of abolitionism? There's something real in there, right? And when you read George Jackson's prison writings, like you see like, you know, this is more radical than anything Europe can produce, right? But when, you know, when it's pulled out of the context and when it's out of the experience of revolt, it just becomes another thing you read in the Black Studies course, right? But when he says stuff like, all reformism is fascism, and you really take that to mean what it means.
FDR was a fascist.
What's up?
FDR was a
fascist. FDR is fascist. Yeah, that's some deep shit, right? To be like, you know, this whole order that Biden is the fascist, right? Or like Obama is the fascist, right? If we really trace out the implications of that, that means an overthrow in a very deep way, in a deep and horrible way, right? That no liberal ever wants to see, right? We're not like on their playing field anymore. So at least to say like, to talk about what history means to me, it means that, right? It means to say like the traditions of our world to be lived in some way, right? To say that the Civil War is still a battle that we have to fight, right? And a battle we have to fight in the way that in 1936 we had the Abraham Lincoln Brigades, but now we're gonna have the John Brown Brigades, right? To say that like when Malcolm X said that, you know, I don't want a white person in my group except John Brown, but what would it mean to say we have thousands of John Browns, right, ready to go for it, right? So, or even, you know, and it does come from the recognition that we're on stolen land. It does come from the recognition that, you know, the places where we're at were segregated at some point, and to be like, when we rip them apart in a way that acknowledges that, you know? So, but that was a dope question and should be a text, right? So I'm gonna get you, you're gonna keep writing. You're gonna start writing that.
Is hip hop alive in one shot right now? Hip hop in there. Hip hop in there. Hip hop in there. Hip hop in there. Now everybody clap. Free. Wish I could take the tears and replace them with laughter. Blow and live, brother, stay.
Long live Palestine.
Long live Palestine.
Long live Palestine.
Long live Palestine.
They call me a terrorist. Now they don't know who the terrorist. When they put it on me, I tell them this. I'm all about peace and love.
But they call me a terrorist.
Now they don't know who the terrorist. When they put it on me, I tell them this. I'm all about peace and love.
Peace and love.
No, no.
We don't want them.
No, no.
We don't want them.
No, no.
We don't want them.
We don't want them.
Power to the shy ones who will struggle to make friends, and the half of humanity worth less than eight men. Power to those that risk their life. Thank you. Respect. Give gangsters gangrene and gain green gradually. Grappling, gate crashing, gathering with a gang of G's. Gallivanting geezers, get guided to the galaxy. Or gallows for gambling with the general's geniality. Glastonbury. You want more? I'm a zealous, a zeppelin and zapping in my soul. So I'm swimming my soul and zap. This song can set us my soul so soon. How many letters left?
Zero!
What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that?
Don't you trust anyone?
I can't hear you. I can't.
You have no
use. Louder, louder, louder.
Don't you trust anyone?
From the kleptocracy, orchestrating, subjugating, corporate state, that is the
freedom.
To reasons of terrorists, we could be standing at the precipice.
We kept faith in
for safety and hopes and love. They are rewards and lives forever. The only goals for us are wonder.
For having us, we love every minute with you all. Make some noise for Kareem and the ones and twos. Make some noise for Sharon on the camera tonight. Make some noise for the great violinist. And make some noise for yourself. Thank you so much. Peace and love.